you all please stand and join us in prayer? Let us pray. In the name of God, the beneficent, the merciful, all praise belongs to the one God, the Lord of the worlds, the beneficent, the merciful master of this day of judgment in which we now live. Thee do we serve and thee do we seek for help. Guide us on the right path, the path of those upon whom thou hast bestowed favor, not the path of those upon whom your wrath is brought down, nor of those who go astray. Amen.
Amen.
You may be seated. In the name of Allah, the beneficent, the merciful, the one God to whom all praise is forever due, the Lord of all the worlds. I hope that we are not frightened by the language of the Spirit. And so let me just take a moment to make sure that we all understand that when I say Allah, I mean God, the creator of all things, the revealer of all truth, and the sender of all prophets. We mean the one God, the ultimate judge of us and this world, and the one God to whom we all shall eventually return. That being said, that there should be no reason for our division, but great reason that we learn one another a little better. It is in the name of the great God, and in the name of his servants, some who I shall name, others that I cannot, but we thank him for Abraham, we thank him for Moses, we thank him for Jesus, we thank him for Muhammad, and we thank him for each and every one of you that have gathered together for the cause of justice. I greet you with the greeting words of peace. We say it in the Arabic language, As-salamu alaykum.
As-salam, sir.
And of course, these Arabic words simply meaning in English, peace be unto you. One thing that is true that I believe our brother, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. declared, he said that peace is not the absence of violence, but that peace comes from the presence of justice. And it is and has been our demands for justice that have caused us to accept this great cause, to organize and mobilize our communities to bring about a permanent and lasting change. You have it written in the founding documents of the country. Dr. King reflected on these words in the famous March on Washington speech, in which he declared, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." Certain things that come before us are obvious. They're self-evident. It does not require a lot of testimony for you and I, many of whom, and perhaps all of us, having seen the videotape of the murder of Oscar Grant, that videotape for you and I has all meant to us information of that which was self-evident. We didn't have to figure out who shot Oscar. We know Johannes Medley shot Oscar. That was self-evident. So when Dr. King said, "We hold these truths," quoting the Founding Fathers' documents, "to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, such as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Well, in order for people to live in a constructed government that permits us life, liberty, and to pursue happiness, there is a prerequisite that must occur. That is, that we live in a world full of justice. We know, as many of us have families that bear direct testimony, that when the Founding Fathers were writing those words, they signed their names to them, but many of them either failed to interpret the words or was straight up lying. For Thomas Jefferson owned, I believe, more than 200 slaves. And while he was writing the document that would become the Declaration of Independence and being its principal author, and while he and others signed the U.S. Constitution that came, some 13 years after the Declaration of Independence, it was very clear that Mr. Jefferson knew that what he and his government had written was better than the people who wrote it. Let me say that again. What they had written was better than the people who wrote it, and was made manifest by the failure of those that wrote it to implement the principles contained therein. That's why Dr. King, 100 years after slavery ended, could stand in the Mall of Washington and recite the Founding Fathers' documents as they provided proof and evidence that what's on paper and what's in practice are grossly two different things. So before we talk about the case of Brother Oscar today, I'm laying a base, because government has a duty and a responsibility. Governments are formed among people to protect the rights of the weak and the poor. This is so because we had seen a world so dominated by exploitative forces that generally the masses of people have suffered, while I'll use the term, a few classes of people have benefited from the work, the labor, the blood, the sacrifice, the tear, and the lives of the poor. This is why we are here. Most of us would not be here except that somebody gained tremendous profits. Not profit, P-R-O-P-H-E-T. Not from people gaining tremendous inspiration from Jesus. Not from those who advanced their condition by following the dictates of Moses. Not by way of those who adhered to the guidance of the Holy Quran and of Muhammad the Prophet. And may the peace and blessings of God be upon all of his worthy servants. But that's not the kind of prophet that brought us here. The prophet that brought us here is P-R-O-F-I-T. It fit their interest to steal the land of the poor. It fit their interest to steal the people to cultivate the land of the poor. It fit their best interest to kill those that stood in the way of their personal desires and greed. And so now we have governments that have to make decisions whether or not the governments will actually protect the interests and needs of the weak and the poor, or will the governments advocate the interest of the rich and of the powerful. And so with that being said as a base, this afternoon there's a few issues that we wanted to convey as we are seeking justice in the communities in which we live. One, we expected a very special guest speaker who couldn't make it this afternoon. So let me just say very briefly that on the question of inoculations that are being offered to the mass public as protections from the swine flu, we want to just offer caution to each and every one of us that is concerned with protecting our health, that believe that the best interest of the public is at heart, as there has been this mass advocacy for inoculations for the swine flu. Question for you, just to consider. What is in the vaccine?
Right.
Second, why have thousands of health professionals refused to be inoculated. There are first responding agencies that have said, like fire departments, police departments, medical professionals, that are very clear about the fact that they do not want to have imposed on them these inoculations. They have found now an end around to implement the inoculations. In New York City, they went into the public school and began with the inoculations. And listen to what they're telling you. They're saying the first recipients should be the weak and the poor. Well,
come on.
Are you really concerned about the weak and the poor?
Come on, then.
If you're concerned about the weak and the poor, when I get a headache, lower the price of Tylenol.
Yeah.
If you're really concerned about the weak and the poor. But the same agencies or pharmaceutical agencies that have not lowered the price of medicine are the same pharmaceutical agencies that in a time of economic crisis are passing on guaranteed profits for themselves. Not Prophet Jesus, not Prophet Muhammad, not Prophet Moses, but profit, P-R-O-F-I-T. I alluded to that earlier. So now there's a guaranteed market for the pharmaceutical agencies. Everybody else going broke, pharmaceutical agencies coming up. What is in the inoculation? Question. If you don't know the answer, then you don't use it. You would be wise not to eat food if you don't know what's on the plate. You ever gone somewhere and somebody brought you a dish of something that looked so different that eating it, you took your time about that? I know some of you thought that way about a bean pie. When you heard about a bean pie, right? Bean pie. I know, because I thought that way. Used to hate it till I ate it. However, somebody could explain to me what's in it. And once that explanation came and I ate it and enjoyed it, then praise God, give me two. But my point here is, if we don't know what's in it and what the effects are, they have said that there are no harmful side effects that you should be concerned about. Are you aware that when the first swine flu outbreak struck and they began to inoculate people, that the inoculations caused severe illness in 500 people? Are you aware of that? Are you aware that last week they went into the New York public schools and began the inoculations of children that was to have been approved of by parents, that they took children whose parents had not given the approval for the inoculations and inoculated at least two children without the parents' approval, both of whom ended up hospitalized as a result of the inoculation. Is there any potential harm from these inoculations? You remember 9/11. And after 9/11, they said, we got to fight biological warfare. Ordering all first responders to get a smallpox vaccination. How did those first responders respond to the demand that they take a smallpox vaccination? Anybody remember? Well, we're in church, so we weren't cussed. But they said no, very vehemently. We will not take that shot. Because the shots themselves carry the disease that you claim you want defense from. That's the principle of an inoculation. You take it a step further. There have been, particularly on the continent of Africa, tainted inoculations.
That's right.
From pharmaceutical companies that are based in the West that have contributed to the spread of disease on the African continent. Question. If there are pharmaceutical companies backed by governments that would poison babies on the African continent, if that is international practice and policy, is there any chance that domestic practice and policy might be similar?
Yes, sir.
Is there a chance?
Well,
if pharmaceutical companies would poison and starve African babies, you've got great companies in this country, wealthy as they are, that will starve out elements or villages out of Africa, will cut off river streams, will turn off the power, will make people to suffer until they can meet their economic interests in those lands, which are the very lands where most of the world's necessary resources are coming from. How do you gain control of the people? Well, you cut off their water. You make them fight their government. You cut off their resources. So when you hear great sanctions against certain governments, some of that is to cause the people to rise up in anger against their own governments. Now, this is simply to offer, sisters and brothers, that when we hear this mass promotion for inoculation. Now, how do you know? Weather is changing. Our noses are running a little more. How do you know that what caused your nose to run, your temperature to rise, your condition to feel a little down, that there's anything different from the flu that you have now from the flu that you got 3 years ago?
Come on.
Do you really know? You feel pretty much the same. Weak, tired, lethargic, fever, some loss of appetite, sweats, aching joints. Well, we've always gotten those kind of feelings with the flu now, haven't we?
Make it plain.
Now, if that's true, then what makes this particular strain so different that it now has caused on government to say to every school's child in the country and other places, let's now consider and begin to implement these inoculations with our children? Now, some would say government wouldn't do any harm.
Please.
We know better. Government harmed us. We know better. Government harmed the native people. We know better. The government experimented on black soldiers in Tuskegee, Alabama, and allowed them to live with disease while they thought that they were under treatment in what came to be known as bad blood experiments. We know better.
That's right.
You had in San Francisco nuclear experimentation. In the Bayview Hunters Point community, we know better. You have in Vallejo, government had black men carrying tremendous weaponry that exploded on them at the point of Chicago, killing, I forget the number, 220 or so men who were parts of the U.S. military. We know better than to think that there is not experimentation done against poor people, prison inmates, will be among the first made to take the shot. I've met inmates that have undergone medical experimentation. One brother came to us one day at Solano, and he was very disturbed that he had a stomach pain that he thought maybe may have been resolved with some Alka-Seltzer or some over-the-counter medication. He said by the time they were done with him, they just about had given him an organ transplant for something that he did not need and did not discover that he did not need it for some months after the fact. So that there are inmates who become the first victims of pharmaceutical experimentation. I've gone into Kaiser Hospital with my family and children, and there'll be signs up. Will you volunteer to receive this vaccination under testing? Well, my answer is always no. I will not volunteer. In fact, I won't even take the vaccination you say that my children are supposed to have to go to school.
Right.
That's me.
Right.
Now, when we see this massive campaign to inoculate, I'm not telling you not to do what you think is best to protect your health, but I'm asking you to think about what you think is best to protect your health.
Right.
Are we together on that?
Yes, sir.
Now, our expert, one of them, Dr. Achille Graham, who is a helper in the Millions More Movement Ministry of Health out of Houston, Texas. He was scheduled to come today. He could not make it as he hopes to make a California trip rather than just an Oakland trip that would allow him to visit the town halls in San Francisco, Oakland, go down to Los Angeles in one journey. And so, God willing, our brother will be with us sometime in the next month or so to share with us. But as we are awaiting his visit, just keep your eye on the news. Think five times before you get a shot.
That's right.
Yes.
And don't think the same way each of the five times.
Right.
Each of the five times, get some extra information. We will try to put up more in our emails and in our websites information. There's one letter we put up on the invitation to this event website on the Facebook of why some black doctors are rejecting the inoculations. We want you to take it in as information, as guidance for your life, because one of the problems that we have is that we're often ill-informed or not informed at all. And we have, because we want to trust that government would do the right thing. You know, on January the 2nd, we trusted that somebody was going to arrest Johannes Messer. We were wrong until we made them do it. Is that right?
That's right.
We want to trust that government would do the right thing, but remember, those in government are no greater than you.
That's right.
And your and my charge is to put before government the actual fact and truth and demand that it act in harmony with fact and truth. And one of the issues that actually helped launch the town hall meetings in the various cities is one that was introduced to us first in San Francisco by the poisoning of our children by the Lennar Corporation, one of the most prolifically known developers in the country, but not only known for building a lot of homes. You know, I'm noticing something about these big companies, by the way. The more trouble they get in, the more PR work that they do.
That's right.
Now, I'm not in San Francisco except to visit and support our family and activate where I can some levels of help. But do you all know I get emails from the Lennar Corporation? And they don't know me. They know my brother, Christopher. Hate him, but they know him. Right? Okay. But I get emails just about every other week of some property sale that's going on. It's not personal to me, it's some general PR thing. But just about every week, while they're poisoning our children, according to what I know, they're sending me emails of homes for sale at increasingly lowering prices. So whether those homes are in San Jose or in the Tracy area, in the Pleasanton, Livermore, I get emails just about every week, and it seems like the deeper they go in evil, the more productive they become in public relations. As the Bay Bridge failed, BART went on a PR blitz, and I received more emails from BART. I mean, it's almost unimaginable how much email I get from BART. Bay Bridge closed today. Extra trains. The Bay Bridge is fixed, but you want to stay on those extra trains. And as each day unfolds, look, we had more sales on BART tickets while the bridge was down than at any time in BART history. Like, I care. But it's a PR blitz that has gone on as they've declared from January the 1st everything that they've done, and they stated this at the state legislature, has been to fight the PR problem. that occurred when Oscar was killed. And so as we are talking about PROFIT and the impact that it has on the poor, I want to bring before you a sister of ours who has been an advocate for the poor and those that have suffered injustice as long as I've known her, probably have witnessed her work before immediate introduction, because our sister had been a helper. As I understand it, the late Kwame Ture, formerly known as Stokely Carmichael, in an organization called the All African People's Revolutionary Party. And for I don't know how many years, and I don't, maybe a couple of three, because she's only about 20 years old, a couple of 3 years, and she has been advocating for poor people, and more specifically, as I was learning about what happened in San Francisco, we would discover that Oakland is full of properties, perhaps not the equal of Bayview Hunters Point nuclear zone, but full of properties that are dangerous and hazardous to the health of people. And as we were looking into them, we found our sister on the battlefield, taking toxic tours of people around the East Oakland area. And as you know, there's a block or two right up the street, a brownfield zone, where the gases coming out of the earth were so overwhelming that the neighbors were getting nauseous and getting sick. And on, I think it's 31st or 30th Avenue, right up the street, there have been multiple cases of cancer of the neighbors of this former plant. And there's a daycare right next door. And the only thing that separates you from the gases and the elements of poison coming out of that earth is a chain link fence and a graffitied over warning sign from the EPA. As I have witnessed, I have not yet seen any work done to actually correct the condition. It's just three blocks up the street. No work has been done other than to put up the sign. Children had used that vacant lot for a playground until they acknowledged the poison coming out of the ground enough to put a chain link fence around it. And so those and many other examples like that proliferate the communities of Oakland, and our sister has not only studied it, we've got maps, charts, information, facts, and details about the poisons that surround our unprotected community. So please join me in receiving to the microphone our sister, our activist and scholar, who's a professor in environmental racism at Merritt College. Please receive our sister, Imada, Nehanda Imada.
Thank you, Minister Key. Good evening.
Good evening.
How's everyone?
Hi, ma'am.
I'm always humbled when I'm given an opportunity to speak, and especially following such a dynamic speaker as Minister Keith. I was telling, there's a couple of my students here, I was telling him how well-trained in public speaking and just the whole style of speaking that the Nation of Islam teaches its children. I was praising his son, Brother Salih, who I've heard speak, and I wish he could train me, because I'm a little humbled and a little nervous, but we will manage to get through this.
That's right.
But I really appreciate Minister Keith starting off talking about Dr. King, because one of the things that we don't know about Dr. King is that when he was assassinated, well, some of us know that he was in Tennessee, in Memphis, advocating for the rights of sanitation workers. And today, in the environmental justice movement, which I'm going to talk a little bit about today, Dr. King's advocacy for sanitation workers is now being seen as one of the early environmental justice fights, because He was fighting not only for economic justice for these sanitation workers, these brothers, to have the equal pay for the same job as their white counterpart workers were enjoying, but he was also advocating and speaking for their safety and for their health. And so many now who are looking back in history and sort of reclaiming history that often suppresses our connection to these movements, that Dr. King is now being seen as one of the early environmental justice voices in our history. So I appreciate you starting that off. But I also want to acknowledge another voice that you mentioned. Since it is November and it is almost that time, when that day comes about when we say that we are celebrating what we are thankful for, many of us fast from eating on that day in remembrance of our Native American brothers and sisters, and I think you know what day I'm talking about.
We don't need turkey that
day. And in thinking about this upcoming day, I'd like us to honor and remember our indigenous brothers and sisters for what they have taught us about honoring Mother Earth, since my topic today is about the environment. We know that the Native Americans of this land, the indigenous people of this land, just like our African brothers and sisters indigenous to Africa, have deep philosophical, spiritual beliefs about our connection to Mother Earth. And so our connection to these ideas are not new. It's as ancient as our DNA, as our blood, as our history, along with our brothers and sisters here, the true owners of this land, our Native American brothers and sisters. So I want us to honor that and think about that as this time of the year approaches. And yes, I've been involved with this movement for about 30 years. I've been an environmentalist and I drove my family crazy. I've been recycling and composting for 30 years. And it was kind of an odd place to be. The only young black student in the entire environmental studies department at San Jose State in the late 70s, and then again to the master's program in the 90s. And so I've been committed to this, and I think it's because of something deep in my own African heritage, wanting and yearning for that connection. But when I became an activist, as Minister Keith talked about the other part of my worldview, I began to say, yes, I love whales, yes, I love the spotted owl, but I love my people.
That's
and
right.
I'm concerned
right.
about my people's health and the impact of this environmental degradation on my community. And so I began to shift from some of the view and the lens that I had about the environmental movement. I mean, I was, I rode my bike everywhere, you know, I rode it to anti-nuclear rallies all the way from San Jose to San Francisco. I was really, really committed to this. And once I became more aware of the social justice movement for African people, I began to wonder, how do these two things fit together? And at that time, I did not know that there was anything called an environmental justice movement. And so that's what I want to talk about today. The first time that this term environmental racism was put on the map, it was put on the map by Reverend Ben Chavis
right.
in 1981. And I'm not sure of his Muslim name today.
Benjamin Muhammad.
Benjamin Muhammad. Many of us know that he was a part of the United Church of Christ and the NAACP, then the Nation of Islam, as his own social justice activism progressed. But he said as early as 1981 that what this term environmental racism means is that it's racial discrimination that is deliberately targeting ethnic and minority communities for exposure to toxic and hazardous waste sites and facilities, coupled with the systematic exclusion of minorities in environmental policy making, enforcement, and remediation. And he did not make these comments out of the blue. There had been organizing in Warren County, North Carolina. There was an African-American community that noticed that there was going to be a site to dump PCBs, a very toxic, carcinogenic, toxic waste substance that was going to be a waste site put in their backyard. And so they began to protest this and began to work with the NAACP, Reverend Ben Chavis, and people like other civil rights leaders like Reverend Fauntroy. And they began to organize to stop the building of these waste facilities in their neighborhood. And for the first time in the history of the mainstream environmental movement, there was a demonstration of mostly African-American folks, and 400 people were arrested. Never at any environmental protest, whether it was for whales or for trees or for whatever, 400 people had never been arrested. And so we put that on the map. An African-American community in rural North Carolina put environmental racism and environmental justice on the map. And this led to, in the mid-80s, to a study that was commissioned by the United Church of Christ Commission on Racial Equality, again led by Reverend Ben Chavis, to do a study called Toxic Waste and Race. And this study, you can find it online if you Google Toxic Waste and Race, it proved that the number one factor in determining where toxic waste facilities were located was race and low income status. If you took a map of the United States and you put the location of African American communities, Latino communities, low income communities, and then you did an overlay of where the toxic facilities were, they'd match up. And this study demonstrated that this was a fact. And so this concept of environmental racism has been developing and the movement has been growing. And today I work for an organization that is fighting for environmental justice. It's called Communities for a Better Environment. They've been doing work in the state of California for about 30 years, but in East Oakland we've only been there about 3 years. And I am their community organizer for the work that we do in East Oakland. But what I further want to say is that this idea of honoring and respecting Mama Earth and wanting environmental justice is not new to us as a people. But as we saw from the example in North Carolina, that we begin usually when becoming connected to this, when it's something that's affecting our immediate health, where we live, where we work, where we learn, where we pray, where we play. When something is impacting our children, when something is impacting those things that are close to us, is when we begin to see the connection. But I would like to show you another connection that many of my students that I, when I teach, I bring some popular culture into the classroom to give them an example that this is not too new to us. How many of you have heard Marvin Gaye's classic album, What's Going On, 1971? Okay, we got some young ones in here that know about that too. Well, there's a song on that album called Mercy, Mercy Me. What's the rest of the title? Mercy, Mercy Me. What's the rest of the title? Mercy, Mercy Me. The ecology. The ecology. Now, what is he singing about? The ecology. The study of the environment, the study of ecosystems, the study of nature. Well, let's just see. Mercy, mercy me. Things ain't what they used to be. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison in the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Mercy, mercy me, Father. All things ain't what they used to be. Oil wasted on the ocean and upon our seas. Fish full of mercury. Mercy, mercy me, things ain't what they used to be. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby are dying. Mercy, mercy me, things ain't what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more abuse from man can she stand? Marvin Gaye, 1971.
That's right.
I might have scared you out of here. Also, we know that Oakland has a strong, rich tradition of social justice. We know that the Black Panthers started here. Last month was the anniversary, the 32nd anniversary of the Panther Party being founded here in Oakland. And something that I didn't know, that the Panthers also were concerned about the environment. And, you know, as I'm in this field and I continue to learn and continue to dig deeper, I met David Hilliard, and he told him about the class that I was teaching at Merritt Environmental Justice, and he said, yes, we were just about to have an 11th point on our program that talked about building sustainable communities, and we had a solar project in LA, and I was like, wow, I've never heard anything about that. And that, again, the challenge in surfacing suppressed history about our movement. But I did see a video clip of Bobby Seale at a concert in, it was the early 70s, mid 70s, and at this concert, it was a big, huge concert, Stevie Wonder and all these people were performing to raise money for some activists who had gotten put in jail. And Bobby Seale came to the microphone, they stopped the concert, and he came out and gave a speech, and he started talking about the only solution to pollution is a humane revolution. And he talked about pollution in, you know, more terms than just what we normally talk about in terms of hazardous facilities that we know exist in our communities, but pollution of politics and pollution, you know, of the air and the water. And so it's just amazing to me to continue to learn about the connection that we have with this movement. I want to bring it down to Oakland and to East Oakland and the work that Communities for a Better Environment is doing in East Oakland. For the last 3 years, as Minister Keith said, we've been doing something called the Toxic Tour and showing the hazardous facilities that exist in East Oakland. And we know that they also exist in West Oakland. We know that West Oakland is surrounded by the port. West Oakland has a number of brownfields. These are plots of land that were formerly used by toxic businesses like battery factories, or they could have been nurseries that used pesticides. And then when those facilities are gone, there's no cleanup of that land, and it becomes a toxic, empty lot. And there are many of them all over West and East Oakland, because those are the two areas that have had the most industrial development historically. Many of us don't know that East Oakland used to have a General Motors Chevrolet plant where Eastmont Mall is today. And so these heavily industrial parts of our city have a lot of toxics that are left behind, and some that are still there today. And so in our toxic tour, we talk about this. But before we could even do the tour where we take people on a bus through the neighborhood to show them where these facilities are located, we had to do the research, we had to do the study, we had to find out the facts about what existed. And so one of the first things that we did in 2007, we did a community mapping study where we worked with community folks that we outreached to say, let's look at this one geographical area that we call the Hagenberger Corridor. Hagenberger to 98th Avenue, San Leandro to International. There's about 42,000 residents in that portion, geographical area of East Oakland. And let's map what we see. We know that there's a statewide map online that the California Air Resources Board says there's 40-something facilities, and there's 8 schools, and there's 2 churches, because they have to do an inventory of what those things are on the California Air Resources Board inventory of hazardous facilities. Well, we took community members, and we were trained to use GPS devices, and we said, what do we see? We live here. Usually we know what exists. It's just a matter of us documenting it and presenting it in a factual scientific document to say, see, this is here, we told you it was, but now here it is in this format. Well, our community members found over 200 different types of toxic hazardous facilities, from metal foundries. There's a metal foundry in East Oakland called American Brass and Iron that's been there for 100 years that spews out sulfur and lead and all kind of toxic chemicals that blow down wind to our neighborhoods and to our schools in East Oakland. We found clusters of auto body repair facilities. We found recycling facilities that are improperly burning computer parts. And so in this study, this mapping study, we created a map to show where all these toxic sites were located, next to schools, next to senior centers, next to homes. Whereas the state inventory said there were just a few of those, we found a lot more schools, a lot more senior facilities, so that we could take this document, this study that we did with community members to city officials and say, enough is enough, we're burdened with enough of this toxic pollution, our bodies can't take anymore, you need to figure out a way to make these facilities clean up and so that our health will improve. And that's basically the goal of our organization, is to advocate for the health of our communities. I want to end by talking about this concept, the toxic triangle, because East Oakland and West Oakland is just one example of the many urban toxic communities across this country. But here in the Bay Area, we also have Richmond, we have the Chevron refinery and all the refineries that are clustered in the Contra Costa County area that are giving our people cancer and all kind of respiratory illnesses. And our agency does have a team of people that are working on that Chevron case and what's going on in Richmond. But if you looked at a map and you looked at the Bay Area and you looked at where these toxic sites are, you would see them clustered in neighborhoods like Bayview Hunters Point, where the old Naval Shipyard used to exist, which is a very, very toxic facility. You look across the Bay to Richmond, and you come down to Oakland, and it looks like a toxic triangle. And so there's this concept of a toxic triangle in the Bay Area that Minister Keith mentioned that we're working to bring attention to elected officials at the federal, state, and the local county and city levels, again, to say that the violation of our health is a human violation.
That's right.
And that we have the human right to have clean air and clean water and clean soil, and that's what environmental justice is that folks who live in the hills, they should not have cleaner air up there than we have in the flatlands, but we do have dirtier air in the flatlands, because the diesel trucks that pass through our communities along the 880 corridor. We want to spread out the pollution. Let's have the diesel trucks pass on 580, which we know that there's a city ordinance that won't allow diesel trucks on 580. Why is that? Well, that neighborhood is more affluent. They have, historically had more influence and power with city council, so they got them to pass a law not to allow diesel trucks on 580, so they all pass through our neighborhood and give our children asthma. The number one reason our children miss school because of hospitalization due to asthma. The highest rates of asthma are in East Oakland and West Oakland. And so I have the map for you to show where some of these toxic facilities are located. But I just want to end by saying again, remember, at this time of the year, to honor, one of the best ways to honor and respect our indigenous brothers and sisters is to learn more about how we have historically respected Mother Earth, and to try to figure out how to live within more respect with Mother Earth, to do less harm, to walk more softly, and work for environmental justice. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Sister Nahanda? Before she takes a seat.
Do you think that this rapid growth of breast cancer in women is due to this toxic?
The question was the rapid growth in breast cancer, yes. The rapid growth. I think the highest concentration of breast cancer is in Baby Hunters Point in this country amongst women of color. And if you look at Baby Hunters Point, it's surrounded by, you can see it on this map, all these toxic facilities. And so, yes, it's the pharmaceutical industrial complex, the chemical complex, it's all of these things that's in our food, in the air that we breathe. Yes, and again, it's concentrated in our community. So as a result, the increase in cancer in our community is directly is more and more being directly correlated to the environmental pollution and the amount of chemicals. There's thousands of chemicals that aren't even regulated or tested in this country. And yes.
What are some of the solutions?
The solutions. Well, the first step is to become aware that these issues do exist. There are laws on the books that need to be enforced, pushing our elected officials to enforce those rules. For example, there's one rule here in California that diesel trucks should only be allowed to idle their engines for 5 minutes. And that's because diesel pollution is one of the most toxic kinds of exhaust that comes out of those trucks that we see up and down the street, and it lodges into your lungs and it causes respiratory illnesses, asthma, and cancer. Well, if the law was enforced, it would reduce the amount of pollution in the air. So enforcing regulations that are on the books, knowing what those are, and pushing our elected officials. Communities have to be organized. If the elected officials that we have now are not doing things to change the direction that we've been going in for way too long, we should elect them out of office as a solution and put some folks in there who are concerned not only about the environment, but about Oscar Grant. You know, put some folks in there who are going to really make a difference. The first step is organizing. Organization decides everything. In my opinion. Yes.
Coming over here, I was listening to the radio and Living on Earth was on, and they just announced a new study that shows that the chemicals that are in Teflon, that are used in cooking and in furniture, stuff you put on the furniture to keep it from getting dirty, or on carpets, is causing cancer.
Yeah.
And, you know, people go into these stores and buy these things without knowing what's on them.
It's like the inoculation.
That's right.
Get those old cast iron pots and get them back.
Right.
Exactly.
Same.
You know, again, this stuff is not new to us. We talk to our grandparents and, you know, our elders in the community, what they used to do to clean their house. A lot of it we're bringing into our own houses with toxic chemicals, clean products. They used to use vinegar and water, lemon and water, you know, baking soda and water, you know, bringing all these tons of chemicals into the house because we listen to the TV pollution and, you know, polluting our brain because we need to go out and buy all this crap. So a lot of this is going back and relearning what we already knew and honoring that and not thinking that, you know, we can't imagine life without Walmart. Well, yes, we can, because Walmart wasn't always here. We can't imagine life without Walmart and all those consumer goods that come from China that people throw away in 6 months. And the site, you know, so a lot of it is, it's not just individual choices. It's, again, getting organized.
That's right.
Last question.
Just real briefly, it's not really a question, it's so much a statement. Like Professor Imari had mentioned about the cancer rates, my grandma has Alzheimer's. I've seen like a rise in Alzheimer's and dementia in the last 20 years. When I'm at Merritt and I look down over Oakland, there's like a cloud that hovers over Oakland. cleaner and crisp in Montclair. I drive through that way on purpose and then start to drive down the flatlands and the air becomes very thick. Not only that, in my opinion, like with the, when we're talking about environmental racism, I'm also talking about the amount of trash that's on the street, all that stuff goes, is in the air and in the environment, all the different stores and things they sell, that stuff goes into our bodies. And, you know, no grocery stores, things of that nature, all this stuff is part of environmental justice. In my opinion, when they talk about civil rights movement, and I say this a lot, it seems like there's a stagnation in the movement. It needs to still move. And we can't imagine life without Walmart. And, you know, we have this area where the factories and all of the 880 trucks are down here. And this is the main place where people are having asthma. I have, like, I work with children at such the highest rate of asthma. Nobody can breathe. You know, so I think it lessens our lives even more just having this concentration of pollution, not just in the air, but on the land and in the water. We're right here at this water, and it seems like because of convenience, we conveniently drive by mattresses and things like that on the street, which bring rats and things. These are nesting areas, so we conveniently overlook things because we say it's not our problem, but it is our problem. If we don't do anything about it now, we are part of the problem. Mm-hmm. So together, that's when we can come up with a solution. It's not one solution for all of this. It takes many members of one body.
Let me make one final announcement about solutions. I forgot to mention that would be remiss. A couple of my students are here, and one of the things that they have to do in class is a service learning project, and one of their activities is solution oriented. They're doing an event on November 19th, that's Thursday, November 19th at 6:30 at Youth Uprising on MacArthur Boulevard, and it's called Get on the Green Bus, Eco Justice for East Oakland. We have some flyers here. And they're going to have people who are talking about things that they're doing, not just talking, but urban relief. Sister Kimber Shakur, who's planting trees all over Oakland. She's planted like 12,000 trees in the last 9 years. And trees are very important for the air quality and the water quality, and just for beauty and peace of mind. And so there's people doing a lot of stuff in our own community that we don't know about. So at this event, we're going to have them talk about the organizations that are doing these things, that are bringing green jobs to us. Everybody's talking about green jobs. Well, we should be the ones to benefit from it most, because we're suffering most from environmental pollution. So it behooves us to learn about this movement so that we can take back our air, take back our health, and also if it's going to benefit the economy with new jobs, we should be the first ones to get them.
That's right. Allegations that are made when we find that these industries and developers have targeted the communities where we live, they often will declare that we are making jobs for you poor people.
Right.
And we'll buy out political favor of those that know that the community needs jobs. But as our sister just stated, the jobs that they ought to be seeking are the jobs of cleaning up the community, that we can receive the training at Merritt or Laney or UC or whatever is required skill and can come back to the communities where we're from to make them cleaner and safer places while we're living, and can do that for a living. And so we want to just make sure that we never confuse the need for jobs with the reasoning that these industries and developers should have their stake in the community, because they're not thinking about you.
Yeah.
They're thinking about themselves. They're thinking about the PROFIT. Now we have to move on to the police pollution that we've been trying to clean up for some time now. And in the latter part of this meeting, we want to make sure that everyone is reminded that our brother, Brownie Polk, was killed by an OPD officer, 71st and East 14th Street, just a few months ago. And like the trial that we are supporting the family with, there is videotape of that shooting. And like the trial that we are confronted with, there is silence from law enforcement because wrapped up in the law of personnel rights for police officers, the public has yet to have been informed what officer shot Brownie Polk, what were the results
of the
internal affairs investigation, because anytime there's a police involved homicide, there's absolutely an internal affairs investigation, but due to police bills of rights and employee rights, we have yet to find out whether or not that shooting was considered a right or wrong shooting with clarity, except for the immediate press releases, which generally are lies. They're denials.
That's right.
So you don't hear law enforcement say, we are looking into this matter. They generally say, our officer was under attack. He was defending himself or herself from lethal threat. The victim had a weapon on them, and the result was the officer killed the victim. Well, generally, there's not videotape to tell us one way or the other. As in the case of Brother Oscar, there is videotape. But we have yet to see the videotape, and neither has the family. And so we are anxious to discover. Now that there's a new police chief for the city of Oakland, whether these kind of affairs will go as they have gone in the past. There has to be greater transparency in law enforcement and its actions with people, particularly where there's videotape. The new chief of police of Oakland, and we hope he does a very good job, Chief Bass. He's been in town about a week now. He and Mayor Dellums had a town hall meeting last Monday evening in West Oakland. I don't remember the location. But they are planning two more town hall meetings. Now, we don't have anything against the new chief nor the mayor, but we want to make sure that the new chief and the mayor know that there is a part of the community that's organizing to secure and ensure that policing is done rightly in the city of Oakland.
That's
right. So the same community that has risen for justice in the murder of Oscar Grant is there for every other act of injustice that occurs at law enforcement hands. We want proper policing.
Right.
So I want to encourage all of you, if you can find it in your schedule, Monday evening at 6:30 at Cesar Chavez Elementary, I think it is, school, at International Boulevard, in about 23rd, in International Boulevard. It's a big new campus right there on International, where Police Chief Bats and Mayor Dellums is introducing the new chief and what are some of his intentions. And one of the things that we really want to be clear about is the problem that our community has is not one of the police not making enough arrests.
That's right.
I went to visit a friend today at Santa Rita, and when I got there, I was one of the few black men that wasn't on the other side of the wall. There was hardly a black man to visit any inmate there. The visitors were generally black and Latino women, mothers, wives, girlfriends, mothers of children, of the inmates. Well, the inmates look like this room, except male. The visitors, female. And we already know that the arrests and convictions of black men means like one in every three black men is behind bars right now in his young life. And so we want to be very mindful that as we want better safety, increased sentencing is not made our communities any safer, and increase of reasons for making arrests have not made our communities any safer. And in the horrific incident that happened with the girl in Richmond, what they have said was that they have now put up new lights and they're investing millions of dollars in cameras.
Now.
Well, a camera is an after the fact
effect. What about,
Putting up a camera does not prevent a crime from occurring. In fact, they are now seeking to invest in the city of Oakland schools. They've received a Department of Justice grant, and they want to now wrap a million more or more dollars around the campuses with cameras.
Yeah.
Well, I think that you would do better to get $1 million worth of social work done. $1 million worth of health care. $1 million worth of new people. $1 million worth of cameras. What are they going to do with the cameras except support greater conviction rates?
Say that. Say that.
These are the same schools, by the way, that have a horrific dropout rate. And now that our young people have conflicts on campuses, many of those conflicts are resolved not by sitting brothers together and saying, well, what happened?
Well, he called me or such and such, and he was talking to my friend, and he said,
okay, you've got youthful fights breaking out.
Right.
That require adult, mature, righteous counsel and guidance.
That's right.
Okay, brother, you gave him a black eye. My brother is one of my former students, and he'll tell you that if a student says something so egregious to his brother, and his brother punches him in the eye, I might have said to some of his brothers, why'd you punch him in the eye? He said, because he called my mama such and such. I'm not saying what he did. I'm just making an example. Let me get this straight. You called his mama these names, and he punched you in the eye. Okay, well, is there something else you could have done before you punched him?
Well, he pushed me, and then he called my mama.
Okay. So you got a black eye. Well, you shouldn't have called his mama a name. You're punished for calling his mama a name. Now, you, the puncher, you're punished too. However, you should know the next time you use such language, if somebody puts their fist in your throat, you earned it.
That's right.
Don't come running to me for protection. You should have learned how to speak the right words and do the right thing in the faith and the sake of brotherhood.
That's
brotherly
counsel. That's brotherly counsel.
Yes, sir.
Teacher.
Y'all with me now?
Good teaching.
I'm not going to call the police if you punched them in the nose.
That's right.
Teaching.
No, we're going to teach them
how
to settle your differences.
That's
now, we deal okay now. Why were you arguing in the first place?
That's right.
Now we find a way to make better human beings, not seeking ways to increase incarceration.
That's right.
I have a problem with that. Hearing that the new system that Oakland schools desire is one that allows you to look down on your children all day, every day through Google Earth or something. Where maybe a parent or school security can look at everything that, I don't want my mama to have seen everything I did. Because there were some lessons I learned as a young person that were better suited in the absence of my mother. That's just true. There were some mechanisms of self-defense that I would not have developed if my mother was standing there. Some things I had to talk my own way out of. Y'all were, that's broke. So, no offense to the mothers, because mothers want to defend their babies. I got that. But the baby's going to have to learn how to negotiate life.
That's right, man.
Y'all with me now?
Yes, sir.
Especially our boy babies
yeah.
that has not been as well guided as they should be. So we want to keep our eyes on all the elements of law enforcement in our community. Now, of course, the significant issue that we are confronted by now, we know that Judge Jacobson has granted a venue change request made by Johannes Mezzali's attorney, Michael Reigns. We heard from our sister, Dr. Tosco, last week a question that we do need an answer for. And that is whether or not the prosecution that represents the people has equal access to appealing the judge's decision as does the defense. In the Rodney King case, the judge's first declaration was to deny the venue change motion. That case was appealed by the defense, the police officers. Then that case was moved to a county that looked nothing like Los Angeles County, Simi Valley. Based on the appeal of the defense, the case was moved. But the argument there was the politics of the city was so thick that you could not ensure fairness there because the mayor had fired the police chief and the judge was in some political arrangement with others, and as a result, they moved the trial. Now, in this instance, elected officials did speak, but elected officials did not make accountable anybody in any position anywhere, the BART elected officials. While you heard from one or two their vote of non-confidence in Chief G, those one or two were not empowered by the vote of others to get Chief G fired. Chief G is still BART's chief.
That's right.
He's just taking a leave of absence before his retirement. So he built up all these weeks of sick pay over the years so that he does not have to face the changes that are pending in the BART Police Department, but the BART Board of Directors didn't exercise any political force against Chief G. So how does that compare with L.A., Judge Jacobson?
Right.
In L.A., the police chief was fired. In BART, no officer has been fired. Does not compare. Y'all with me now?
Yes, sir.
The controversies of Los Angeles were a little different. And so they utilized the case of Los Angeles as case law precedent for the venue change motion for Johannes Mezzali. However, it's not a perfect fit, and it's not a perfect match. One of the things that we are very concerned about is the judge's statement that the prosecution did not offer any experts to dispute the defense attorney's so-called expert. His so-called expert was a race-baiting sellout to the Mezzali defense. He wasn't just an expert. They paid him well. In fact, if I understood, he was paid $200+. It was supposed to be $225 an hour to offer his expertise. In a couple of weeks, he mounted up a great number of hours. And when it came time to testify, he actually admitted, "I haven't even talked to Mr. Raines about my pay." Then what motivated you, sir, to get involved with this case? He got in court and began reading San Francisco Chronicle blog. He took every piece of information of news media to testify from the San Francisco Chronicle. Why did he do that? Well, let's see. You've got Chip Johnson, who writes for the San Francisco Chronicle, that anything strong and black in the city of Oakland, because he's a black writer, they have him write against it. Y'all with me now? You've got those who wrote in their blogs. This is not news. These are individual, anonymous opinions. Why should an individual, anonymous opinion be part of a court record? And he came and began reading some of those blogs that said things like, you know, another N-word loses his life in Oakland, so what? Another one bites the dust. And these kinds of, now I'm being a lot easier than he was
right.
Being, until the judge, Jacobson, had to stop him. But what you had in this expert was one that accepted the premise that black activists and politicians are wild and out of control in a city full of wild and out of control black people that would make it impossible for a jury to feel safe coming into the city of Oakland to host a trial. were the same folks that would have trouble coming into Oakland for a trial are the same people that would have trouble coming to Oakland anytime. It's the same mindset. But if you can't have a fair trial in Oakland, then I would say, next time I go to Santa Rita, I went today, I would say maybe we should go to the warden and ask how many of these brothers and sisters, or brothers in Santa Rita, were tried in Oakland. Since you cannot get a fair trial in Oakland, let my people go. Well, you can't get a fair trial in Oakland. I would argue that there have been many apparently fair trials in Oakland. Systemically. And this is not the first case that required an increase of security. And so what? You have to have an increase of security.
Yeah.
That's going to happen wherever the case goes.
That's right.
So the fact that the sheriff had to amend his day-to-day operation to accommodate a big-name trial, this is not the first big-name trial in the city of Oakland.
No,
the rioters were tried here. The Bailey case is being tried here. There are big cases that have cameras following the defense and the prosecutors all day, every day. What makes this case different is that a law enforcement officer is on trial and the evidence is damning him.
Yes.
That's what makes it different. The evidence is there. The only thing different between this and the rioters, with the exception of the known fatality, we don't know in the rioters' case, are there unknown fatalities. In this case, we have a known fatality verified by videotape. Now, that's not our fault. The press would lead the public to believe that because of activism, that there cannot be a fair trial when this country was built on activism. They're out there right now arguing against Obama, calling themselves the Tea Partiers. Is that right? Right now, the biggest argument against Obama's health care plan is a group calling themselves the Tea Partiers. The country was built on verbal, vocal, active participation and expression of what you now have as your freedom of speech rights.
Yeah.
Right.
So the last thing that we would allow is for the media to continue to manipulate the public. They're now trying to force the public to remain silent when the public should be speaking. So we are honored to have and continue to organize and mobilize around this case. Here's the dates we need to know right away. November the 19th, which I believe is a Thursday. Which I believe is a Thursday, will be the venue change. Hopefully they'll conclude it that day, but it seems that every step of this case has taken longer than it should. And in this venue change decision, it's not, as I understand it, Brother Bobby, I spoke with Wanda, and she said it's not that the judge wants to hear from the prosecutor and the family, but that the judge wants to hear the defense's argument of the two cities that have been named, meaning they want to give the defense an opportunity to say we like or dislike Los Angeles or San Diego. I have a problem with the defense being the only voice in this. Should not the prosecutor have an opinion? Should not the family have an opinion? The state is not going to spend a dime to help the Grant family travel to Los Angeles, take days off of work, spend money in a hotel, and get themselves a bite to eat while they're there. Is that true?
Oh, no, they're not going to spend money.
Now, perhaps out of our circle, we need to find out whether there are victims' rights advocate groups who have supported the families of homicide victims. I'm aware of them because one of our brothers was a victim of a homicide in 1998, and these advocacy groups helped to offset the cost of the funeral. I wonder how many victims' rights advocates, be they black, brown, red, yellow, or white, agencies exist that know the struggle that your family brother is going to have to go through to go there and stay there long enough to ensure that justice is served. Is anybody aware of any of these advocacy groups?
The city of Oakland has victim of crime group that you could, but it's not. Of course, they don't have that much money now, but that's the only one that I know about. I can check.
You'll check. So we have a researcher that when we meet again, we'll know whether or not we can find a way to wrap some financial support around the traveling family of the Grant family. And, of course, if we could do something special ourselves.
Definitely.
You know, there's a number of artists who have stepped into support of the Oscar Grant case. Mr. Fab has written a song, I love that song, a tribute to Oscar Grant. A brother of ours coming out of Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, Jasiri X, you can look them up on Google, YouTube, I'm sorry, and see that there's been a number of wonderful artists that have offered their talent of song and pen to the case of Oscar Grant. I think that coming into the first year, maybe together, we can pull together a few of our minds and resources to host an event that will help raise resources, and they haven't asked. I'm asking.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Right.
The Grant family.
Yep.
That we do something. And if we can pool our resources, bring our talented artists together, I know that if we called Tony, at least one of the Tonys, but probably all the Tonys, then we can get one of those Tonys to give us some song. Is that right? I think if we call Lenny, he'll give us the ooh ooh song a few times. Yeah, I think there's something that we can, must, and should do so that the family and those that mobilize to support the trial in an honorable and dignified way will go down and represent the interests of the people of Oakland and the family of Oscar Grant. All would you right. support us in that? Do we have a second?
Second.
Yes. Those that agree that we should do something to support yes. the mobilizing effort yes. of the family and community to yes. Southern California signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, keep your mouth shut, but you can say no.
Let's do it.
That's democratic process. So we want to make sure that those that mobilize know that you're in foreign territory, you got to go in the wisest of ways, and we have to make sure that the language that we use is not one that they will say to you one day what you said can and will be used against you in a court of law. So we want to make sure that our words and our actions are right on point. God willing, mobilizers will begin to activate those in the Southern California area to inform them once the final decision has been rendered which city will be in. And there are activists with us that are down there. Y'all remember a thing called the Caravan for Justice?
Right, right.
We went on Caravan 1 and shot them. We went on Caravan 2 and shot them some more. We went on Caravan 3 and they didn't know what to do at that point. Well, as we prepare for Caravan 4, you should know that that caravan has included support networks from the three strike opponents in the Southern California area, from the environmental racism opponents in Southern California, and from those that have been standard bearers against police brutality in Southern California. So there will be a mobilizing effort, but we want to make sure that our mobilizing is wise, that we don't put ourselves into an issue by not utilizing the best of wisdom and planning efforts in whatever is executed. I do know that there are some of our advocates meeting, I don't know the date, Dave, you know the date?
What day?
The mobilizing.
Oh, I think they decided to hold the next meeting on the 19th to discuss after the announcement.
After the announcement. So on the evening of the 19th, some of the mobilizers will be meeting to discuss strategy on how to approach mobilizing efforts in the city and in this city as well as we're looking at the change of venue. So I like that our brother Bobby Cephas Johnson would share his thoughts with us before we close out tonight, of course, he and Wanda are continuing to share the word and spread the word of good news of what's being done for the sake of justice. Yes, ma'am.
Question. The state representing the gentleman who argued against the defense, I guess. The defense is Messerman, right?
Yes.
Okay, so.
The prosecutor.
The prosecutor, he's working for the state. He's not working on behalf. I mean, I know he's working for the state.
He's working on behalf of the Alameda County District Attorney.
So then that is not representation, like, in terms of the family, in terms of the...
Not directly. Okay. Technically, mm-hmm. when there has been a crime committed, the state brings charges representing the people. So the case that you'll see will not say Grant Johnson versus Mesley. It will say people versus Mesley. Because technically, the state is duty-bound to protect the rights and interests of all of its citizenship. Whenever a crime has been committed, it is a crime against the people, even though there is a family and individuals that are personally affected. The family has its own lawsuit, along with others who were there that evening against Barb at this point, and I guess the individuals of police that were involved on that night.
So I'm wondering with Burris, that's right, because of his legal expertise, can't he know if the state could appeal the venue? Because all
as I'm learning that these things have never been done. And one of the hopes would have been that Judge Jacobson didn't simply rely on past case law. In this instance, he used the Rodney King case to make his argument a point. He could have made a decision and set a precedent. Could that precedent have been overturned on an appeal? Sure. But you know, they could have overturned the Civil Rights Act. But somebody had to pass it. So, in my mind, I would rather see someone step out to secure justice than to see someone step back out of fear that my political or legal reputation may be challenged for this. Dr. King was challenged by Christian pastors for his stand for civil rights, who felt that he's stepping outside the prayer view of what a pastor should do. Well, okay, that's what you say. But what did God inspire Dr. King to do?
Right.
You, that are scholars of religion, are not God. Right. And there comes a time in everyone's life that we are challenged to do what others think is best or to do what we believe that God thinks is best. Right. Well, I'm thankful that Dr. King stood with God's word and did not capitulate to the feeling of pastors who thought he was out of his lane. One of his most famous writings was called A Letter from a Birmingham Jail, which was a response to Christian pastors who said that what you're doing in essence is not biblically correct. So we don't want to get into the religious argument, but one thing we do want is to find those that are willing to stand for justice more than we're willing to stand with what's politically expedient. Yes, ma'am.
You know, by accident, I'm just using that, I ended up attending that week. And it just seemed that the first day, the judge really was on the defense. Like when he started reading those racial epithets.
Yes, ma'am.
And the judge really was impressive, like, oh, no, we're not going to do that. But it just seemed as the week went on, like maybe some phone calls had been made to that judge or just something. He seemed to get a little bit more like there was some pressure. I mean, it just seemed like something just seemed something in his disposition, like somebody got to him. And I'm wondering if in the law it cannot be appealed, if in the law the people cannot say, well, we want to appeal on behalf of this victim to not have this move. But maybe if there can just be a mobilization to get the word out for people to understand it, there was only 300 and some people polled. And this whole decision is based upon, you know, this so-called expert. And people not realizing that you have millions of people, or whatever the population of all the different cities of Alameda County, and really getting people to understand that when they say 45% of black people said guilt, that's like 37 people. I mean, because, you know, there were, what,
there were 397 people.
Maybe there were
37 were black.
I mean, people just really do not understand. And I mean, even if in the law we can't officially appeal for this not to be moved, but if 100 of us are standing on those steps on the morning of the 19th, the day before the 19th, just with big signs saying, you know, 37 people surveyed.
And not me.
They didn't call me. You know, just something to just bring some attention to, because the judge has already said, oh, well, you know, the protest, you know, you're protesting. I had to walk by people while I ate a sandwich. Well, okay, if you're going to make that work against us, then I'm just thinking we may as well get 100 people on those stairs peacefully with signs to just say, you know, 45% equals 37 people. Just, I mean, because that was just so amazing to me when those numbers came out, and the, you know, it just, people need to know. Even if we can't change it, just people need to really
know what's happening.
When they're saying a survey says that they're talking about 300 out of the population, 1 million people in the population, 300 determined this.
Yes, ma'am.
Were you asked? Were you of the 300?
Point out the contradiction.
Just something.
I want to thank our sister for her thoughtful commentary. And one of the things I just offer, in addition to whatever we may do on that day, is that they and IndyBay.org have become and are becoming an increasingly forceful voice in the dialogue. And one of the things that differs between the battle between good and evil now and 2,000 years ago, for an example, is that truth has become readily accessible for those that seek it. So we want to spread the knowledge. So when it says biblically, get knowledge, that's the principal thing. Get wisdom, but with all thy getting, get an understanding.
Come on.
Well, part of our role is to give an understanding that somebody can get. And so we're now looking at how to spread this word throughout other areas. Perhaps beginning, we've already begun at Merritt College, Laney College, and other places. Soon we'll be at UC, and as we begin to travel the area and state, we want to make sure that everybody has access to the truth from which to have an intelligent opinion and to do the right thing. Right now, what folk have are the media representations that the entire reason that this trial was moved was a few voices of activism, and they were too frightened that it would get violent and end. I mean, that's the whole story that's told, and that's not the entire story. And so we certainly thank you, sister, and thank Dave for his continued pen and record of what we do. But I want to bring to the podium for our parting thoughts our brother, who was the uncle of Oscar Grant. Please join me in receiving again to the microphone Brother Bobby Seepers.
Once again, I want to thank everyone for coming out. And to quickly just talk a little bit about the polls that the young lady was just talking about. In Alameda County alone, there's 1.7 million people. And of course, there's only like 13% that are considered of African American or black. And so when we look at the polls in itself, right, there was a very small number of 37 basically represent African Americans. And then the percent that actually said he was guilty was really no more than like 15 or 16. You know, so the question that came from us was that, who were called? Well, can we identify who was called? All that was in confidentiality. So the data pool that was used for the sampling can't be investigated. So, you know, we just going by what is told to us. You know, of course, we could talk about more of what's said to us, which really is just, you know, left with us to whether we want to believe it or not. Does the DA have the right to appeal the decision that the judge makes if it's in favor of the defense and it's been expressed to us? No. So again, we left with a prayer. You know, that's all we really left with.
We can always appeal to the highest court.
That's
right. Right. That's our appeal. You know, and we've been appealing that from the very beginning anyway, because we know that the way the system has been structured and the way things have been going in the past, if we go by stats, we're going to lose this case. So we believe in trusting and giving it to God.
That's
that
right.
Win. That's the only way. You know, because evidence and stats has proven up time and time for time that we don't get our justice.
Say that.
You know, and so, but yet, you know, this direct attack on our First Amendment right to speak about what that we do not like that is considered or happening within our community is an attack again on us in our being vocal. You know, just, you know, honestly saying what we see, what we feel, what we have heard is not right. And yet the change of venue has taken this course. And it has affected us. Of course, we wanted to hear in Alameda County. You know, of course, now we got to incur a cost to go, you know, to wherever it goes. And of course, we know that if it goes to San Diego, chances are he's going to get off. Because in San Diego, every police shooting has been justified. So basically, the idea is to get it to a community that is pro-police, and that way it can ensure that what we have seen in the past happen again. You know, but we can't close our mouths to that anyway. You know, and the reality of it is, that could become a reality. You know, how painful it is for us to think about that does hurt, but I've said over and over that it is my belief that we will get justice. Maybe not in the sense of our earthly eyes and court of law,
from
God.
But we're going to get it.
Yes.
God's way in a spiritual sense.
Yes.
But what's happening is awakening us as a community to the issues that are going on about the environmental issues, you know, about the race issues, the class issues. You know, there's many issues that are going on in our community today that we need to begin to really address. You know, I mean, what is it going to take? You know, Oscar's not the first to die at the hands of police officers.
Hmm.
But he is the first in a sense that we've seen on video.
Come on.
The execution that was exhibited in that video. You know, and to us that's like, wow, this stuff really do happen.
Yeah.
You know, and so we all, everybody sees it. You know, but yet at the same time, we know wherever it gets moved to, the whole thing is that what we see really didn't happen in the way that you see it. You know, it happened this way, you know. And that's going to be based on this stereotype that's been placed upon us, you know, young black men, African American men, brown men, about our ways of acting. You know, I thank Minister Muhammad for just sharing the knowledge and the information on a consistent basis. You know, in the last couple of weeks, I've had a chance to go to a couple of different things, and you know, communication is so important today in order for us to mobilize and really be of any power. Communication is tremendously important, because the last couple of meetings I went to, these different other people weren't really aware of other people doing other things. For instance, town hall, you know. We need to, I don't know how we can get it out there more. I'm not a journalist, but you know, a marketing person. But communication is real key. So we that sit in these rooms, we must communicate the word out to those that are yet still doing their own thing, that there's an issue that is going on in this community that we need to address. And the only way we're going to be able to address it is to have some idea of what's really going on.
And that way,
we have to come to things like this, you know, town hall meetings. You know, my sister and I was fortunate enough to be invited to BWAPA, which is a Black Women Organized
for political
Action. And Elaine Brown, one of the original Black Panther members, she was the keynote speaker, and very powerful. But, you know, she said some key things that, just brought it back to my attention that, you know, this stuff is not new.
No.
And what are we going to do about it? I mean, it's big. You know, Marvin Gaye sung, you know, that was tremendous. Just to hear Marvin Gaye talking about that same stuff back then.
That's right.
That we seem to be just now recognizing is occurring, you know? And, but there's a lot of work in front of us, you know? And quickly to this change of venue, you know, we talked about the strategies and how to bring to the media attention that the community of Alameda County will follow this case wherever it goes. And to make known, hopefully, to that community that what happened in Alameda County, you need to truly know about. And to mobilize people there, and there's gonna have to be some strategic ways or strategies that we must try to look at now in order for that to happen. You know, because again, a lot of times we miss the beat because of failure of communication. You know, communication is so key. And how we disseminate this information will be, you know, we have to be creative, you know, because like, you know, I had said a few things like, you know, for me, I want people to know in the community, wherever it's at, that this happened to my nephew. Well, how would I do that? You know, for me, maybe passing out CDs of the Oscar Grant tribute video. You know, I like when, I forget his name, that was on the BART train and how he disseminated a lot of flyers concerning the Oscar Grant murder and the issues. Christoph, that's right. And the issues around that. You know, I mean, some of the same things that we've done here really worked.
That's right.
And there's no reason why they wouldn't work in any other community.
Right.
But the only way they will work in the community is that people have to band together to actually make it happen. We have to duplicate basically what we've done here, there. And I love when Minister Muhammad said, as go California, as goes the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seemed like this community, as you know, the Black Panthers originated here, but many other activists have originated right here. But this community always seemed to start the real heartbeat.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, if we want to really get something going, because, you know, we've been saying about a year now that history is being made. You know, and we're a part of that history. You know, and for us to really establish it, even in the law books, we have to band together, we have to communicate, and we have to share this passion with other communities about the injustices that have occurred. You know, this gentleman here, I don't know, but I listen to him, and he wakes up in the middle of the night and just writes into the wee late hours. What comes from inside him concerning Oscar Grant case. You know, and there's many other individuals that does that. You know, many go unheard. But, you know, I'm loving what I'm learning. Even though it was the worst, you know, it's that way where you can say, that was the worst day of my life, but yet the best day of my awakening.
Come on.
You know what I'm saying?
That's all right.
All right.
So, you know, I'm just going to cut it. I got to run. But I just thank you for listening and, you know, and beginning to address these issues. Even showing up, you know, taking time out of your own lives to come to hear and to learn and come educating and passing back to those that yet still don't know. And I've said this, when I was at San Francisco State in 1985, I can remember I was sitting in class and I heard these Shenanes and Hadaris and Tabaris. These young sisters were naming their kids that. And I remember I was in African studies and I was studying about these African kings and queens. And, you know, the names, the surnames were just so, like, right on. And I was wondering, I'm saying, but do they know what they're naming their kids? And in a sense, there was a silent movement taking place unconsciously by us. Because these sisters were naming our kids their real names.
Come on.
And 30-some years later, or 30 years later, acceptable, Vienna, not acceptable, Obama sitting as a president.
Huh.
You know, basically coming from our continent. Mm-hmm. I'm like, wow. So the battle is raging on, but somehow we need to really bring it to the conscious. Let's stop making it an unconscious battle, but become a conscious battle of doing the real work that we need to do. Thank you.
That's all right.
Suleiman has an announcement, then we're going to make our closing.
Yeah, real quick, brother. Hey, brother, just want to say something real to you, real quick for you. First of all, assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters. Good to see the brothers and sisters. Again, I haven't been here in a while, but I felt convicted to be here today. So me and Francisco, Brother Jamo, from the other side, Hunters Point side, we said we need to get over here and see our brothers and sisters. Brother, just real quick, as we give all praise and honor to Allah, that the movement is still alive. Oscar Grant, we talk about him every day. You may not see some of us because we're over in other cities doing different work, but we have some ideas that I'm going to bring to your attention, what's working in San Francisco that we can mobilize and work with over here also. Because like you said, sometimes we get stuck in trying to figure out how to get the word out, how to get this and how to get that. But there's a team that's working for Oscar Grant over there. There's a team that never left us, Grant, that's over there. So, brother, I want to be in contact with you and my other brother. That's your brother-in-law with the ponytail, because I know they have a meeting that goes down at 6 o'clock. See, we need to all come together, because we have a whole lot of issues that we're talking about. See, this is what we do in San Francisco. This is a flyer that says, attention to all San Franciscans. Attention to Alameda, to all San Franciscans. Just use your city as the same thing. Our communities are suffering. Then what we have on here is all the issues. And I'm going to pass this out to the crowd so everybody can see it, brothers. But these are the issues that we're talking about, and we're talking about getting all the facts, and they're dealing with connections between the redevelopment crime rates, racial profiling, evictions, environmental issues, and criminalization. And these are the same issues that's going on all over the country. So we got to come together. We have a meeting every Monday at 6 o'clock called a Brotherhood. So we formulated brothers. This is brothers from the streets, brothers from all denominations, brothers who've taken the titles off themselves and say, we ain't about no titles, we're just men of God, because we're all suffering the same problem. So what we need to do, brothers, mobilize with the brothers over in Oakland and come over to San Francisco, or we'll come over to you and share some of the ideas that can possibly be effective, because we one movement. We're not two movements. You know, we just may have different town halls, but it's all the same thing. We're all taking the same problem. So we can come together, brothers, and come together with you, brothers, so you'll feel like there's, so you can receive that same energy and get that same knowledge, because each one of us know how to dissect this now. You see, everyone has to take a role, especially black men. They have to be accountable to. We have to know how to go get some of their brothers that's been in prisons, been in the streets, and make them become accountable for what they've done. Refresh your mind to say, brother, if you have sold dope for 20 years, then you owe 30 years of community work in the streets to rebuild some of the problems of what we have done ourselves. And you know, we get great results from brothers, great results from brothers saying, yeah, brother, I need to come to that. And we need to do the same thing, apply the same remedy over here in Oakland, add it on with your creative ideas too. Add it all in, and then we mobilize together. So if you have a date, you have meetings, we need to come to your meetings. If you have a date over in San Francisco, we need to constantly, constantly replenish, constantly nurture, and constantly build each other. So we'll know these topics, and we'll know these topics, we'll know how to go, because Christopher Muhammad and Brother Keith Muhammad, these brothers here are our leaders. and our Archbishop Kings and Francisco de Castas, but each one of us have a job too, and there are a few labors. But once you come into this movement, you learn to understand that, and once you put this in your heart, that you got to love the people more than they love themselves. And once you figure that out, then you'll know. And once a brother figure that out and that light come on, that I got to love him more than I love myself. So you got to take, we got to go outside of here. We got to go outside of the mosque. Now we're going to Sunnydale. We're going to Hunters Point. We're going to Valencia Gardens. We're taking the message to where we are becoming street ministers everywhere that we can possibly go. Because when Jesus was preaching, Jesus didn't wait for them to come in. Muhammad didn't wait. So since you are becoming a disciple of the streets, then you have to take that same attitude. You got to go door to door. You got to go to the byways and highways. You can't worry about the rain. You got to say, okay, this is what we need to do. So 2 days out of the week, which we're going to bring in the format, we're going out. If you got a town hall that meets, then we need to be in that area with town hall flyers. Because our people are so asleep, we got to wake them up all the way up to the last minute. We almost got to grab your hand and pull your hand and say, come on, brother and sister, I love you. And when they see your face and they see that, man, you really do care. But consistency and being in their face on a consistent base and saying, brother, I'm back again. I'm Freddy Krueger. Yes, I'm back. I'm in your face again because I love you. And once our people see that and they see that love, they're like, yeah, you do care about me. And that's all they want to see is some people who's committed to the commitment. And that's what we have to develop over here. If we got some brothers over here that need to be resurrected, then we need to resurrect them. Because they have the abilities to go out and do these things. And they need to be made understood. But sometimes it takes certain brothers to tell you, brother, and then God gives you your call and says, you need to be doing that. And if you're speaking up on stuff, then you need to point that person to doing it. Because to be talking about it, then you got to give them the lift and say, yeah, you need to take charge on something like that. That's what Christopher does to me. If I open my mouth, Brother Suleiman, you take charge of that. But then I'm ready for the charge for the love of the people.
Right.
And I just wanted to come here and lift up the crowd and let you know that Oscar Grant lives. He's with us, and we're going to keep fighting. We're going to keep pushing. Okay? And I'll see you later.
On that note, let's close out in God's name. Would you all please stand and join us in prayer? Brother Suleiman, if that's in a format that can be emailed to us,
yes, sir.
Then we can
amend
it in the words that you just mentioned.
Yes, sir.
Let us pray. In the name of God, the beneficent, the merciful, all praise belongs to the one God, the Lord of the worlds, the beneficent, the merciful, sole master of this day of judgment in which we now live. Thee alone do we serve, and thine aid we seek. Guide us on the straight way, the way of those upon whom thou hast bestowed favor, not the way of those upon whom your wrath is brought down, nor of those who go astray. O Allah God, we thank you for bringing us together in peace, to establish justice, and to do goodness and righteousness, which is your will. It's in the name of your righteous servants that we pray, and we say together, amen.
Amen. Amen.
Of course, let's thank the founder of this house, our pastor, Reverend Gordon Humphreys, and all those that helped us to meet today. Give each other a